Shelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
March 24, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. This indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, Thursday, second to last broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect and O'Shelly.com Radio. Not sure if Aaron's going to be with us live on Friday, but I guess we'll find out Friday night. Maybe not. I know Bob Wilson has a plan for over the weekend. And maybe a surprise broadcast on Saturday in the middle of the day. Stay tuned. You'll find out about that at some point. Anyways, what do we have tonight? The great Mike Swanson in the first hour. And, you know, he's the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. He's the author of The War State, a book I highly recommend. Also, Why the Vietnam War, which is the first in a series on the Vietnam War. An excellent book as well. Very complex issues of historical record, you know, broken down in such a way that they are easily digestible, even for, you know, simpletons like myself. And he's also written a history of Danville and things like that. Check out Mike's work. You can find it all on WallStreetWindow.com and also on Amazon and all that good stuff. In the second hour, we'll have the failed state update with J.G. Michael and Joseph L. Flatley, the co-host of that podcast, and I have no idea where that's going to go, but we might have another discussion briefly, maybe about 5 minutes, about the failed state update jukebox once again. I don't know. We'll see what happens in the second hour. There is no script. So here it is. Mike, first of all, before I turn it over to you and ask you how you're doing and everything, I just need to make one other announcement that I did sadly confirm. What I was told while I was on air last night, that Jordan Maxwell has departed this life, and he will be missed. I found him to be a great philosophical teacher, and he's somebody whose name most people who listen to this show know. He did say, I forget if it was on the air or off air, the last time I spoke to him before he was going to go to his big birthday party, his 80th birthday party, that would be his last. And, you know, people say things like that to me all the time, and I never know, I never know when they're right. I should have known Jordan was right, I believe I'm attempting to arrange a tribute show for Monday on the O'Shelly Effect dedicated to Jordan, his work, and his life. The details and all that about exactly what happened to him. I know he was sick for a while, so it is not a surprise, but it is a blow nevertheless. So, Mike, I hate to give you the down note to start with. It's just that I wanted to address that directly. I have done it in graphics and on social media, but just wanted to make sure that listeners of the show know that, those are the final interviews that I'll ever get with him. I do have some material that has never been released with me and Jordan. I'm going to review that stuff. Not going to release it Monday, but I'm going to review it. And because I would never release anything that I felt besmirched the man or embarrassed him in any way. So I'm going to go over some of these conversations and things that I recorded either accidentally or decided not to release at the time. And we may have a special unreleased post-life Jordan Maxwell show later, but I do plan to give a tribute to him on Monday. So, anyway, Mike, sorry about all that. I know we have other things to discuss, but you know he was an integral part of my show. I must have interviewed him at least 60 times on this show, and interesting guy. And I actually loved him.
Did you talk with him? Was he one of your very first guests?
No, he wasn't one of my first. He was a little later. Like maybe about a year after I started, and people heard some shows I did and actually were saying to me, well, you need to have Jordan Maxwell on your show. And I knew who Jordan was and really didn't think I could get him on my show because he had been on, like Project Camelot. And if you check him out, you'll find that he was on, you know, lots of History Channel documentaries and things like this. And he's been a well-known alternative, media figure for a long time. So I thought he was one of those guys I'd have to wait a while to get to. I got in touch with him and, you know, just humbly said to him, you know, look, I'd really love to have these discussions with you. I have learned a great deal from you and all that. And he said, sure, right away. And I did like an hour with him, I think in late 2014 or early 2015. Did an hour with him somewhere, and later he was kind of pleased with that, and we ended up doing a very long series, which he didn't do with too many people. He did one with Project Camelot and all that, and he has been on, you know, like every podcast you can think of as far as like alt media stuff goes. I think even Alex Jones has had him on. I mean, everybody had Jordan Maxwell on, but I didn't really think I was going to get him right away, and he just was real gracious and real, you know, straight up right away did it, no problem. And later on actually approached me about doing that Dogmatic Theology series, which was controversial to some people, but it was, you know, Jordan's work, and there was actually 25 episodes. One episode he did not want released, and 24 of them are out there. Anyways, I'm sorry.
Well, when you first started the show, was there a guest in the beginning that really helped the show grow? Or, you know, one of your first episodes that really got attention or something like that?
The first four or five were pretty interesting because I had, like, Joan Mellon on. And then I had James Corbett on. Now, Corbett I had asked on because I had been a guest on his show a couple times. He kind of had me on as a Lee Harvey Oswald expert, believe it or not. John Barber I had on in the first five. I had the guy from Architects and Engineers for 9/11, Richard Gage. And now I'm struggling to remember who else was in there. But I tried to put like some of the best people I knew and had contact with already right up front for the live show. So, but Jordan wasn't even on the list because I didn't know him personally. I just used to watch his work, you know.
Does Corbett still have the internet? Do you know if he still has the International Forecaster?
I don't know if he talks to Salenti anymore, because that's Salenti's thing, right?
I'm not sure. It was Bob Chapman's.
Oh, that was Chapman. I always mix that up.
And Chapman died. And from what I understood, I don't know who, but I don't know who they are.
Well, Salenti was Trends Research or whatever. Yeah,
Trends Research.
Okay.
But when
sorry,
I knew Bob Chapman. Because time goes by. 20 years ago, I went to a gold investing conference. It was the very first investment type of conference I ever went to.
It makes perfect sense. Chapman would have been there, but yeah.
Yeah, and he was there, and he was an interesting character. So I got to know him. I got mixed feelings about him, but I got to know him. I'm not going to. But anyway, he had this thing called the International Forecaster, mm-hmm. and when he died, somebody took control of it. I don't know who they are, but it was sort of like, you know, he had a big newsletter with 10,000 to 20,000 people on it.
Right.
And that's a pretty sizable, you know, list. And this Chapman guy, he would spend all week writing this thing.
Right. Well, didn't he do it with his wife?
It was like 50 pages long.
Yeah, no, it was huge. Didn't he do it with his wife?
On and on and on, you know.
Didn't he do it with his wife, too, or was that...
I don't know how much she really helped him, but they were very close couple.
Yeah.
I met both of them.
Right.
And, but at some point, I had the impression that I'm not saying Corbett was one of these people that took control of this after he passed away, but somehow the International Forecaster began to get referenced on Corbett's website. It appeared as if Corbett bought it or something. That's why I'm asking these things. I'm going to their website, the International Forecaster, and I can't tell, you know, what this is, who runs it, if it's the same thing, you know, because what can happen a lot of times is these websites, after someone dies, the domain name can expire and somebody can take it over. So I don't know if this has got any, you know, if they just, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, or a small
Corbin
amount
have gotten,
of... Right.
Corbin may have gotten the Chapman list of names, and this thing I'm looking at, this website, could be something completely separated. For all I know, it's being run in you know, a foreign country or something.
Well, and somebody also could have just turned around and given, say, you know, whoever was running his estate a little bit of money, and they turned over the keys. You know, I mean, honestly, there's, I know I'm having troubles lately, but there is a set of keys that could be turned over if I were to die.
Well, that's what was kind of unusual about it. Yeah. He had a son too,
mm-hmm.
or he's still Chapman, and I met the son at one of these things, and but he didn't. That was what was kind of odd about it, that he didn't take it over. Very strange.
Well, but that's the thing is, right now as we speak, right, nobody in the world actually has the set of keys except me, you know, to all of my stuff. Even if somebody got control of my email and everything else, they could not control my database, not my on-site or off-site database. Right. I have a way that can be communicated to somebody. But honestly, nobody else has it, right? So if somebody had control of all that, they could literally take it over, re-register everything, and continue on my work. Or, you know, like say they wanted to re-release all my podcasts through Ocelli.com, something like that. And I've got a couple thousand of them. It would take them a little while. They could release, you know, three a week for quite a while, couldn't they? You know, I'm just saying, it's one of those things that happens. Or somebody could take it and continue on with it, keep producing the other shows or produce other shows under the banner. So these things have value. Now, these other guys that have these newsletters, they ended up with massive mailing lists, some of them. And as you well know, those mailing lists are of monetary value to people. So, you know, I don't know what happened with the Chapman situation. I wasn't on the inside of it, but...
Well, so the way Chapman got started, I wasn't planning on talking about this stuff, but he was a stockbroker in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
and he was a real right-winger.
Right.
He was in Liberty Lobby at one point. He was a John Birch Society felt person. So that type of right-wing person.
Yeah, and he was also a foundational guy for, like, Alex Jones' media sphere early on.
Sure.
Chapman was right in there with a whole bunch of guys that, you know, anybody who listens to Jones today would not have ever heard of now, that were just part of it. And he used to have a regular segment on the Alex Jones Show when that was, you know, really starting to climb.
I've never said this on the air, but, yeah. Well, I'll get to something.
whatever you want. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the way he got big is... There's a big John Bircher in the 70s called Gary Allen,
right?
And he wrote a book. I can't remember the name of. Do you remember the name of it? No One Dares Call It Conspiracy, something like that.
No One Dare Call It Treason, right?
Treason, yeah. No One Dare Call It Treason. Then another book with something about a conspiracy in it. But these two books, small paperbacks, have to be, you know, one of the best selling, the two, among the two top selling conspiracy type books ever written. I mean, they were so heavily promoted.
Yeah, they're right up there with
the 1970s.
Yeah, they're right up there with like the Turner Diaries and all that stuff.
I would say they're even bigger.
Bigger. Okay. Well,
yeah, as far as the number of copies sold.
Fair enough. But the thing is, how do you even count those? Because at certain points in the 70s and stuff, people were like pretty much copying books and, you know, reproducing their own versions.
Right. But Gary Allen had some sort of newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died, Chapman got control of that.
Right.
Bought it or was given to him, whatever the case.
Right.
And that's how he changed the name of it to the International Forecaster. So when you say Alex Jones was, you know, when he was getting his start, at some point Bob Chapman was one of his sources.
Yeah, he was one of his main presenters. Mike, you faded away there for a second.
Really?
Yeah.
And anyway, he was kind of real eccentric, put it that way, but. We, in 2003, I think it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't even tell this story, but invested. it's a crazy story. I invested in a gold company.
Okay.
And I got, you know, it was going to go public.
Is this when you were still a hedge fund guy? You did this or?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough.
And they had properties in Nicaragua.
Okay.
That they were going to bring into production.
Right.
I can't even remember the term of it, but they didn't have to dig, they didn't have to dig like a mine in the ground, and it was the type of mining where you just surface type mining.
Like we could do the pan thing, like say in the streams, this kind
of stuff. Well, I mean, you got machinery. I mean, it's not that, you know, substantial mining, not just like a couple people doing it.
Okay, substantial stuff, but close to the surface, so it's not a difficult thing to go mining for it. Okay.
Right. And the thing had been in production before and then went out of production.
Okay.
And this company had the rights to buy it and bring it into production.
Okay.
And Chapman invested in the stock. And I invested in the stock. And then I told a few other people to invest in the stock, friends of mine.
Right.
Well, Chapman's writing this newsletter, and the stock hasn't started to trade yet. And I mean, this is pretty crazy. I bought the stock for something like 25 cents a share.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, he writes this newsletter, and he puts this on all these financial websites.
Right.
They're publishing, it's an article. And he says that this stock is going to open up like for $10.
Okay.
For $10. And I had bought how many shares? It was a lot of shares.
And you're talking about a 40 times, you know, the original purchase price increase. That's a hell of a thing.
Let's say I bought $25,000 worth of it. I don't really remember the exact number, but just it was at least that.
So much. You're talking about $1 million off of a $25,000 investment.
That is how much I bought. That is exact. I bought $25,000. That's what happened. So he's saying this.
Yeah.
And then he, at the same time, he was involved in some other company that was already trading and was exposed in an article as putting out false information. It was another mining company, and they were claiming that they had all these resources on their property that they did not.
Okay.
And this thing, someone wrote an article about it and saying Chapman is recommending this and he's tied into these people. So that article comes out. Chapman writes an article predicting this stock is going to the stock I bought is going to open up at $10.
Right.
Right. Well, the day comes, it opens up at $10.
Wow.
I was worth $1 million.
Let me guess. You didn't trade out right away, though, right?
Well, I couldn't. I was locked in.
Okay.
For a certain, like probably 4 months, you can't sell the shares.
Okay.
And I was at the time I had an office, and I was showing it. Look, the stock was at $10. And I said, I wasn't excited at all about it, at all.
Well, I'd be excited if I put in 25 G's and I got $1 million coming back
for what I bought.
Okay.
It's just.
I'm sorry, Mike, you went away there.
The Securities Exchange Commission halted the stock.
Okay.
And then they started an investigation into CEO And also subpoenaed, I didn't get a subpoena, but they subpoenaed a bunch of people. Some of them I knew. And I ended up as a witness trying to help them in the end, talking to the SEC.
Okay.
And because I'd lost money in this, you know, I wasn't part of a scheme or something, and people I knew lost money in it.
So you were an honest investor telling them, listen, not everybody who invested in this was a schemer, because look, I lost money on it, because by the time this you know, came down and your 4 months was over, you didn't have 25 grand in anymore, did you?
Oh, no, exactly. Okay. And I knew I was never going to get anything. When it starts trading at $10, it's just not going to... It's not, you know, it's too crazy.
Well, nowadays, it's the dream, though, isn't it? Isn't that like the dream? Like, you know, okay, I put in, you know, $2,000 and it returned, you know, 4,000 times profit, you know? I mean, isn't that like the thing?
Yeah, but it's not real world stuff, you know?
it's doesn't happen often is what you're saying. Like, I always find that funny. You know, it's like, if I would have just had, it's like people with the lottery. If I would have just picked one number different. Yeah, right. But you didn't. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's exactly. No. So, but what happened was, I mean, when I say I talked to the SEC, this was like 2 years or something, 2 or 3 years after the thing was halted.
Right.
And I went up to Washington and did that.
Wow. Okay.
Drove up to the headquarters of the Securities Exchange Commission. Yeah. But after it was halted, Chapman vanished and fled the country.
Yeah, he left. He did leave the country. Yeah, I remember that.
So, and the last, I don't remember when, this happened so long ago, so I can't make an exact timeline here.
Right.
But I spoke to him. And one of the last conversation I had with him, he told me he'd written stuff. Again, this is 2003. He'd written an article about 9/11 and Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and this and that.
Yeah.
And George Bush is gonna kill him, and he's got to do something, and he might disappear. So that's what he did. He vanished.
Well, see, and that was part of Jones's thing for a little while is, you know, Bob Chapman is in exile somewhere and we can't reveal his location. He would still have him on the show, like over the phone.
Well, I found out where he went. I'll get into that in a second. But so he vanished. fled outside the United States.
Right.
And people thought, yeah, he's telling me, or he told me, he's fleeing George Bush.
Right.
Now, other people thought he's fleeing because he did something in this stock, something crooked with this stock. That's what most people assumed.
Right.
Now, in the end, I mean, I have no way to know, but in the end, I thought this turkey is just getting out of here because he bought this stock with all these offshore accounts.
Right.
And I just thought, this guy's just, you know, he's probably getting investigated by the IRS or some crazy crap, and he's probably got something to do with taxes.
Well, he wouldn't be the first guy to turn around and abscond with a bunch of money after a failed, you know, something or other, and then just go somewhere where, you know, extradition's not easy.
Well, I really don't have any. I have no reason to think he stole money from this company.
Oh, no, I'm not saying he did. I'm just saying
anything
that
like that. But
if he's even under suspicion for it, Mike, I'm saying this would not be the first guy to flee, even if he's under suspicion for it, and then to claim that, you know, it's a political hit job because of something else. I've seen that before. I can't think of who else off the top of my head, but I know I've seen these patterns before where these guys have, you know, something going. It goes south, an investigation starts, and they're nowhere to be found. That kind of thing just occurs. You know?
But I'm trying to suggest that he may have actually fled, not because of the stock investigation.
But because he was worried about the
Bushes. For tax evasion purposes.
Okay.
I don't know. Regardless, when the SEC halted the stock, they put a grand jury investigation on the CEO of the company, who then he was living, he was a Canadian citizen, and he, you know, I became convinced he was kind of crazy after all this unfolds, but he, he was living in Florida, and then he took off and left the United States, and also is making claims, like similar claims to Chapman, but he was running a financial website, no longer exists, and he started attacking the SEC on his website, which to me is really crazy, you know, in this situation. But what ended up happening was, because I, you know, met these Securities Exchange investigators, they were really after this CEO. And, I mean, they were after him. And he had done other things. He had a long, you know, a history. And he actually, between the 3 years that the stock was holding and I spoke to these people, he started another one up that was doing strange things. So he was, you know, really kind of, which it's just kind of crazy.
So Chapman, but, Chapman may have been somebody who just kind of got sucked into something, as these guys do.
That's what I think. Like, he got sucked into it.
It's like the Salenti thing that happened some years ago, if you remember, where he was like, you know, calling people stupid for, you know, buying gold contracts and saying you should only take physical delivery immediately. That's the only way you should give them your money, you know. And that's the way he was advising people. And then it turned around that somebody burnt him on a whole bunch of gold contracts, and he got really upset because he lost a lot of money. And then that came public, and he was like, well, you know, and people are like, oh, that's interesting. Everything you told other people not to do, you did, and now you got beat, and you're mad. Well, you should have taken your own advice. These guys, they get caught up in stuff sometimes, and, you know, nobody is a perfect genius in that world, man. That's the way I see it.
But what the crazy thing is, when I went and talked to these SEC people, I talked to them for like 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, they made, in hindsight, as when I think back on this, they made a lot of mistakes. Well, I mean, I knew they made a lot of mistakes, but one of the mistakes they made, and a friend of mine was also up, you know, doing with me.
Which, who made mistakes though? The SEC or the Chapman slash this CEO guy?
The CEO guy made hundreds of mistakes. He's just nuts.
Right.
But the SEC made some mistakes too.
Yeah.
And one of the mistakes was me and a friend went up there and testified, and we testified under oath.
Right.
In this room, like a board, like a little boardroom.
Right.
With the SEC lawyer, and then I don't remember. I just remember this SEC lawyer and someone typing the deposition, recording and typing the deposition.
Yeah,
I just
like
remember
a stenographer and somebody
else.
Maybe another
person. I didn't have a lawyer. I didn't care. But one of the big mistakes they made was they didn't talk to us before they started these. I mean, they immediately put us on the record.
So they didn't even pre-interview you for the deposition?
No, they didn't even pre-interview me. They just, right on the record, okay. You know. It's just, and then during the deposition, the lady, she did two interesting things. I mean, this went on forever. And she's questioning me about my background and this and that. And one of the things she did, I mean, this is before Edward Snowden, right?
Right.
And she put out a piece of paper that was an email that the CEO wrote to somebody.
Okay.
That I don't even remember what it said, but.
But they showed it to you.
Yeah, they showed me this email, and he was like boasting and bragging about something, and it sounded real incriminating, but I can't, you know.
And it wasn't an email that was sent to you, it's some other
communication. No, it was sent to someone else.
Okay.
And this is before Edward Snowden, so I saw that and I'm like, holy crap, they could track anyone's email, you know?
How'd they get that? This was new to you. This was new to you.
Yeah, that was new to me in 2005 or 6 or whatever it was.
All right.
It was like, wow, they're tracking, they can track anything. That's pretty crazy. And then, but the other thing that this, one of the other things this lady did is she asked me all these questions about Bob Chapman.
Mm-hmm.
And they came off as if they thought Chapman was like a mastermind of this whole thing. And, you know, because he predicted, I guess, that the stock would open up at $10, and it did. They took, in reality, I think Chapman was, I'm certain of it, was just somebody that couldn't help but brag about things he was involved in.
Well, he was trying to pump up his own investment to that level, right? Because
in sounding, do that, but he wanted to. He was trying to impress people of his own importance. And, you know, he was saying, you know, saying different things and exaggerating his importance in this company and role in it. And then he had to show off.
Right.
You know, someone probably told him we're going to open the stock up at $10.
Well, yeah, but you don't think that was a way of just trying to make money, because obviously if he put in the same kind of money you did at 25 cents a share.
Oh, yeah, it probably was. Good to build excitement.
Know. So you build excitement, and you know, it's like that one stockbroker guy on TV is constantly, for some reason, turning to one fast food chain that he keeps going to, right?
Kramer.
Yeah, Kramer. He's always talking about Wendy's, isn't he? So I mean,
I haven't watched him in a while. But
well, I don't know. Somebody made a compilation of like
just, I believe it,
like 50 times in the past year. He just is like, Wendy's. We love Wendy's. My wife loves Wendy's. She eats a big burger. They kept like showing these clips over and over again when he's doing his dance, you know. And one does wonder when you find out that maybe the guy's got an investment with Wendy's or whatever. Right? So it's like free advertising.
But they were convinced that Chapman was like a ringleader and all this.
The guy who dreamed it up and
giant figure. They were after him too,
right?
And I don't really think he did anything to amount to nothing.
Well, but then again,
and they
were
obsessed with him.
But you didn't see all
that. And also because he fled the country. He's fleeing them and acting guilty.
Well, that's the other thing. And also, you know, look, the guy, you don't have all the evidence they had. It might have looked like to them that he was the guy behind it. And since you had been in contact with him, maybe they were just prodding you to see if they could get more to make their case with. You know, what did you know except what, well, the guy told me this or that, and that's hearsay. So what did you have?
Nothing but hearsay.
You know, did you have communications with him? Did you see any, you know, any behind-the-scenes numbers that maybe other people didn't get to see? I mean, it seems all logical. It's just funny to me that you're involved in it. they bring you
well,
in.
Well, the thing that got me is the friend of mine that went too, his dad is a judge in Canada. At the time, he was a lawyer.
Okay.
But now he's a judge. Mm-hmm. And he had written essentially a legal brief and gave it to his son.
Okay.
Of, like, you know, a legal brief. And I don't have the documentation or any of this stuff with anymore, but I could literally have taken a piece of paper and pointed at it. And shown that these people are breaking the law right here. They're breaking a securities law right here, right now.
Right.
You know, and they have, you know, didn't ask me anything about that. They did when they finally charged the guy, and there was a settlement. That wasn't part of anything that, you know, nothing. It was just nothing.
Didn't even have to admit to wrongdoing.
He done several things.
Okay.
Yeah, there are several things the guy did, the CEO did, that were violating securities laws. None of them that they had any interest in or even or went on after him.
Right.
And the stuff they eventually did get him on, I don't even know if he did.
Well, you know, isn't that the way things work?
And he ended up settling for like $50,000 or some figure like that, like maybe $100,000 at the most. But and they must have poured millions into this damn case.
Yeah, no, that's the kind of thing that happens is they just retrieve, you know, something and they got something to show for it. And that's the end of it. I mean, you know, it is
crazy. In my experience, the lesson I learned from that is avoid any authorities at all costs because it's just a circus.
Stay out of the fray, so to speak. Hey, look,
don't
again,
even try to help.
I did not know you were going to talk about this tonight. So, but yeah, sure.
Look, three years ago, I went to a couple, whenever it was, I went to Walmart at nighttime.
Okay.
And you know, 9 o'clock or something. I go and there's not they're not that busy. I'm walking to the Walmart, and there's an older, you know, black man entering the Walmart too, and then a young girl. I can't remember if she's white or black, but as we were the three of us, we don't know each other.
Okay.
As we're walking in this Walmart, there was a vehicle, you know, we were walking by, and it was like a truck, SUV, and the back of it was open, and this girl was putting groceries in there, and the side door was open, and the father or boyfriend was on the other side of the door. And so you couldn't completely see him, and there was a baby seat, right?
Okay.
And he, you couldn't tell what was going on, but he was yelling, and some sort of movement was happening, but you couldn't really tell what it, 'cause the door was blocking the view, right? You couldn't really see what was really happening.
Okay.
But it is possible that he was hitting the kid. He was really, he was yelling, right? And, or shaking the kid, doing something.
Okay.
But you couldn't really tell. And the three of us stopped.
Right.
And the black man who is older than me, the girl wanted to call the police, right? The young girl that was with us wanted to call the police.
Okay.
And the older black man says, oh, "You don't want to. I'm out of here." He charges. He's walking fast into the store. He doesn't want anything to do with
you're
it.
You're calling cops. I'm out of here. Yeah, that's
yeah,
usually.
I'm out of here.
I'm with the old black guy. By the way, I'm just telling you. I'm with the old black guy. When people go, "I'm calling cops," I'm like, "Yeah, I'm leaving. I don't want to even be involved." So you know.
I
don't
and
call
I'm
police.
Like, we don't really know what's going on. Right. If you call the police, that's what I said to her. I said, we don't really know what's happening. If you call the police, it may not. Who knows? What good is it going to do?
They go. Who knows what that'll
do? What do you
do,
want to happen? Yeah.
Right.
And then I followed the black man in there, and she had called the police. When I walked out, there's the police. Yeah, and I have no idea what happened.
Right. Right.
You know, she the girl that called the police really has no idea what happened.
Of course not.
And so we don't know. I don't know what happened afterwards, but that experience of going to the security exchange regulators, maybe if I had that experience, I might have been standing there, staying with that girl about calling the damn cops.
Well, I don't know. I am one of these guys who's like, just don't call the police. It makes things worse. That's it. I mean, it really, I'm one of those guys. I stand by that. I don't call cops. I tell people that all the time. Even when somebody has accused me of, did you call the police on me? You know, a neighbor or something, like, you're talking to the wrong guy because I don't call the cops. It's just that simple. Some people do that, you know, as a matter of practice. They do it all the time. I never think
and
makes
this
anything
isn't, better. And I'm not, and I say this not to say that the police that would go to that scene are bad or got bad intentions or something that they're going to do. It's just, where does it go then? What's the system going to do to resolve the situation?
Well, I didn't even say that.
If there is a situation.
Well, see, that's my point, is that it's just going to make things worse, whether the system works correctly or not. Most times, I mean, unless it's an absolute emergency, I see no point in calling these people, because it just never makes anything better. You know, even if you got a case where somebody is acting inappropriately, maybe the family's handling it, you don't know, and now what? You know, you get a guy locked up who maybe didn't need to be locked up. Maybe the family needed to handle it. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying I know everything, and I'm not saying, you know, never intervene or anything like this. I'm just saying that I very carefully consider that before I would ever do it, and I'm just not the guy who calls the cops, you know?
Now, that said, there was this same Walmart, mm-hmm. There was a woman. This is morning. I'm good. I went in there in the morning time to do grocery shopping, and this woman approached me. I thought it was an old lady. It looked like a homeless type person or on drugs or something, right?
Right.
And she wanted money, and I just shoot her. He said, "I ain't giving you money." And just walked by her, and then a few weeks later, the same time of day, I'm going in there. And this time, she's coming up to me, and she was a crackhead. I could tell this time, right? Mm-hmm. And I just cursed at her, just get away from me. You know, I didn't call the police on her. You know, I mean. But
no, I got you. You don't have to call the cops.
6 months
or
later,
yeah.
though, mm-hmm. She killed somebody. This woman, and fled the city and got caught somewhere. But she killed somebody.
Okay, but you know,
it was very strange. It snowed.
Okay.
So, you know, no one's driving. Everything's dead. It snowed a whole lot, and the day she killed somebody, and the murder was three women together. They're all doing drugs together, and one of them, you know, she killed one of them. So
weird,
messed up, you know.
No, I got you, but weird interactions with the SEC and at Walmart for Mike Swanson tonight. I'm confused at like where we're going with the story. This is you're thinking about it later because you see somebody. I mean, I've seen that too before, where somebody I've interacted with.
Yeah, but if I did call the police on this lady, maybe she wouldn't have killed somebody, because she ain't going to go to jail for long.
Maybe she would have killed you
for a couple hours.
Well, here's the other thing: maybe you would have got her agitated by calling the cops, especially if she knew it. And before the cops get there, maybe she would have went after you. You know?
Yeah,
I don't know.
She shot the person. Used a gun.
Well, but there you go. Now, if somebody feels threatened, and if the police show up, I mean, you can clearly feel threatened, especially if they're, you know, in their mode. Who knows? Maybe she would have pulled a gun then. You don't know. See, that's
the thing. Speaking of terrible crimes at Walmart.
Yeah.
So.
Besides the Walmart itself,
30 miles down the road from me, at the Walmart in that town, last week, two white boys. I mean, I don't know if the race has any matters or not, but that's what you see.
It's fine. Two white boys,
two white kid punks in this Walmart.
Yeah,
put a chokehold on. I mean, these are teenagers.
Yeah.
When I said these things, two white 17-year-old punks, they put a chokehold on this black kid.
Yeah,
and filmed it. And put it on the internet. And when one of the kids is yelling, tap him out, something. You know, knock him out. And now they're in jail. And they did it to put it on the internet. I mean, isn't that crazy?
Well, yeah, but it's also trended. They had that thing they were calling the knockout game for a little bit, right? To see if you could walk up to somebody and hit them once and knock them out.
I guess it's what they're doing, something like that.
Well, there's all kinds of stuff like that where people do this, you know, do something crazy, you know, get into a fight or whatever, and they show 10 seconds of it on TikTok. and this kind of stuff. I mean, that's happening all the time. Like I said, for a little while, there was it was a couple of years ago, I think, the knockout game, right? Like maybe 2018 or 2017? I don't know. Somewhere in there, there was a trend. Do you remember that?
I remember hearing about it, but I never saw it happen or anything.
Well, you and I are not sitting there scrolling through TikTok either, you know? I mean, we're not, I mean, and YouTube now has their little shorts category, so it's sort of like TikTok on YouTube. And people do, you know, little stunts and things like that, right? You know, they try and jump over a table, or they body slam somebody, or they get into a little wrestling match for 10 seconds. And they put out these little videos, and they monetize them. Some people have literally filmed themselves committing, you know, felonious assaults. It's amazing, because I remember back in the days when, you know, it was like, whoa, look, with the advent of the camcorder. And, you know, many cases around the country where people had taken, you know, camcorders out on little crime sprees. I mean, this just happens. I can't explain it. I don't know why in the hell you would want to film this. I mean, you know, they say, oh, they want to relive it or save it. And even worse, sharing it online. I mean, you know, why not just go out for a bender of crime and then report to the police station with a list? I mean, you know, I don't understand what these people are doing. But, okay. And Walmart is, there's actually a couple of websites, I think, devoted to, like, you know, crazy adventures at Walmart and stuff, where, you know, it's everything
I guess the reason Walmart got on my mind is I went there today to get I got a haircut there, and...
You got a Walmart where you can get a haircut? I never even heard of such a thing. Okay.
Well, when I was getting the haircut, this fellow walked into the haircut thing, and he asked the lady, can I get a haircut? And she said, well, it'll just be a few minutes. And she said, you can sit down. And he sat down in the chair. It wasn't that far from me, and I looked at him. And he seemed normal. And then he got up and was gone. And let's say 10 minutes later, you know, I'm done with my haircut. She's taking me to the register. And the guy was laying outside of the haircut place, having a seizure.
Ooh.
So they called the paramedics, and hopefully he's okay. He didn't look like he was, I mean, I don't know what was wrong with him, but he was talking, so I don't think he was.
Maybe you need to start filming with your phone when you go to Walmart.
I'm not gonna do that.
No, I'm just saying, there are whole websites, though, Mike, I swear, devoted to still pictures of crazy things at Walmart. And like wild stuff you see, everything from people dressed real crazy going to Walmart to go shopping, to you know, people laying in the frozen food section. Like I saw one film of like a woman just squatting and like, you know, taking a crap on the floor. I've seen.
Well, I worked at Walmart when I was in high school.
I was just working up to that.
For 3 years.
Huh? I was going to work up to that, Mike, and ask you, you know, in your time as a Walmart employee, because I see Walmart as one of these, you know, very large evil corporations, but you worked there for a little while, and I was just curious if you ever saw crazy things when you were working there. Because I don't know if they were all 24 hours back then, but it seems like the later stay open.
I worked there right before that started.
Okay.
I really didn't see these type. I didn't really see this crazy. I worked there before those kind of crazy pictures are plastered everywhere.
Yeah.
The internet too.
But even working any retail establishment, Mike, I mean, you got your drunks who come in. You got people come in that are high. I mean, it happens.
The biggest problem I had was this retarded boy, but.
You are all kinds of not politically correct tonight, Mike. I just want you to know that. You're using the retarded word. You're talking about white boys. I'll tell you, something crazy here, Mike. What's going on?
No, that he was retarded.
I know. I'm busting your balls, Mike. Relax. I'm just...
No,
is funny
the problem
to me.
Was,
go ahead.
It wasn't the boy, really, that was the problem. Is his mother. Okay. She would come in there all the time and bring him and just... waste time, you know.
I understand. And yeah,
I guess gotta take them somewhere. And there were people that when I worked there would just come up, go in there and just want to come up to you and talk to you,
right?
You know, that and just waste your time. And that was what she was doing with him and is just annoying.
Well, that's another thing, I mean, when you work retail, is that lonely people who have nothing else to do.
That was the biggest. It wasn't so much like people in those pictures you see dressed funny. It's just people coming in there that ain't got nothing to do and they just want to talk to you.
But you've seen some of that stuff, right? Where it's like, you know, dudes that are...
I don't really remember any of that.
Okay. No, I didn't say
all.
In person.
I don't really remember people looking crazy and this and that.
No, I know. I'm just saying that, you know, you've seen this online, though, right? I mean, some of these crazy things that people film, like, you know, people doing whacked out things.
The most whacked out thing I saw in that sort of sense was the store manager.
Yeah. Oh, the one that quit? That one? Or, because my favorite recent one was this lady who started hucking the candles. Did you see that one? She goes...
No.
She goes, no. You know they sell the jarred candles, right?
Yeah.
So she just starts flipping out about Black Lives Matter. You know, here we go. Now I'm going to be politically incorrect. A white lady, is flipping out and throwing candles at somebody about Black Lives Matter, like, you know, down an aisle, and they're just smashing. As she's throwing them, she's grabbing them off the shelf and throwing them, Black Lives Matter, and she's just throwing these things.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And I'm going, what in the hell is wrong? Like, does everybody who's deranged go to Walmart now? I don't know. But
well, the way the place was when I worked,
yeah.
I mean, it's been a long time. When I was working there, the assistant managers, you know, I don't know what the exact figure is, but they made okay money.
Yeah.
You know, and then the store managers made a lot of money.
Right.
You know, over 100,000 or something back then.
Yeah, no, assistant managers back then could make like a good 40 grand.
Yeah, 40 grand. That's what I want to say, too.
Yeah, but I was told that store managers, because I was up for one of those positions, you know, they were starting them in the Northeast when they were developing them at 125. So, yeah. You know, and I actually interviewed for one of those positions when I was working for Exxon. Because Walmart was not really in New Jersey very heavily yet, and they were trying to establish it with people who had experience, you know, with big chain corporate stuff. So, yeah, I got an interview for one of those jobs, and they were talking like 125 for somebody like me, and that was what, 99 or 2000, somewhere in there, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know I totally understand, but. The thing is that, again...
I think it's kind of like the food industry in that you go to a restaurant and there and you'll see, you know, there are a lot of young people in restaurants
mm-hmm.
that they're just going to work there for a shorter period of time. But then there are a lot of people that they stay in that industry for their life, you know.
Yeah, I don't know what they do now, but yeah, they used to have
Walmart's
guys
like that too.
Were like, yeah, you have like career Walmart people.
Yeah, I mean, there's people working in the Walmart here that were there when I was there,
right?
Which was like 3 or 4 years after the place opened.
Yeah, right. So, and they start out maybe stocking or whatever or doing
30 years ago. I mean, they're still there.
But they
30
started,
years ago. It's how much time goes, fast time goes. 30 years ago.
Yeah. But the thing is, if you're making a decent living, I mean, I get it. And they, you know, they turn around, okay, we're going to make you the head of the electronics section or whatever. Yeah. And then, okay, maybe we'll make you an assistant store manager. You know, if you get to ascend, and only certain people get to ascend, the majority of the employees are pretty much, you know, disposable and interchangeable. Where they're just, you know, sales associates, and certain people rise. I mean, it's just the way it is.
But the goofiest thing, you asked me, what's the goofiest thing I saw someone do? Sure. I don't remember the words used, but one day I was walking in there, and the store manager, who I didn't know, I never even saw the guy, but a few times he would hide somewhere.
Right.
But this time I saw him, and he was beating his head up against a pole. Inside the store. And I was like, all right.
Just like one of those support poles where they might put a scanner or a phone, right?
Yeah. It's okay. Exactly. I was like, wow, this is pretty crazy.
All right. Listen, I can easily beat you on all the stories you saw at Walmart and stuff that I saw working in convenience stores.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Convenience stores are a thrill, especially if you work night shift, which, of course, I always ended up volunteering for because it was like, weren't you afraid of getting robbed or shot? No, it's okay. I'll do that job.
Hey, the convenience stores where you live, yeah. do they have these gambling machines in them?
No, see, Jersey never had that stuff. We had a lot.
What about Georgia?
Yeah, no, Georgia. Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. No, we have them here, and we had them in North Carolina. I don't think they were exactly legal in North Carolina, but they were there anyway. Yeah, no, they have poker and slots and all kinds of stuff.
They still got a lot of them in North Carolina. I don't know how they got it. The laws change year by year, but they've got, like, centers for, entire stores dedicated to them now.
Well, yeah, that's the funny thing is that there's stores in Georgia that, like, the convenience store part of it is BS. The toilet paper is dusty, and it's a brand you never heard of, you know, like Russian toilet paper or Chechenian toilet paper is in there. And it's like nobody buys it. Nobody buys anything off the dusty shelves, but they got two rows of gambling machines. And that's why the store is there, okay? You know, it's in the strip mall in between two nail salons usually. This kind of thing, right? JoJo's groceries, and he's got, you know, three cans of beans and, like I said, the toilet paper and a few other things sitting on the shelf for no reason. Probably everything's expired, and all they're really there to do is handle the machines. So there's that. Plus they have lottery. So, you know, you can go in and gamble with the state or you can gamble with your coins. I've never actually sat down in one of those machines, by the way, since I've been in the South.
I never have either.
Yeah. But I do see them everywhere, and I hear stories from people that, you know, dump all kinds of money into them, sit there, get drunk, you know, because they get the beer at the store, they put it in a paper bag, they sit there and drink that, and just hang out on the chair. Reminds me of what they used to have in bars in a lot of states.
Yeah.
But here, they're just, you know, hanging in the convenience stores. And I haven't seen them in bars here. I've been to some bars, and I don't see these machines in bars. But, you know, in other parts of the country, like in California, they used to have them in bars. I don't know. Anyway, who knows what the regulations are like now, because I haven't been to California in like 30 years, so... But no, it's interesting. Mike, can you believe we almost killed an hour here? With stories from Walmart and Bob Chapman. I mean, you know,
we didn't talk about Ukraine, so it's how we can get away from talking about that.
There's
talk
a bonus.
About next hour.
There's
but
a bonus.
It's so crazy.
I don't know. You know, I don't know what JG and Joseph L. Flatley are going to want to talk about, but I'll be talking to them in the next hour. Mike, before we get going, I mean, outside of obviously people go and be in the know, visit WallStreetWindow.com, buy Mike's books, of course. You know, I actually got into a discussion with somebody at the flea market recently over your book. It was kind of weird. It was a guy who was into JFK stuff and had sampled the show and was asking me about your book. And I was telling him, you know, you definitely got to get yourself a copy and all that good stuff. Hopefully he bought one this week. But anyway, and if you're listening, thanks for, you know, talking to me. But anyway, Mike, anything... oh, crap, listen to that. See, Mike's had a little bit of a rough Skype connection through this discussion, so I don't know if he's there anymore. Mike, you still with me? Okay, Mike may be gone. So you know what I'm going to do is go ahead to the break. Okay, I don't know what was with his connection tonight, but we got weird stories from the Walmart, strange stuff from the land of Chapman, and God knows what happens in gold. With Mike Swanson. Like I said, in the next hour, we'll get the failed state update with J.G. Michael and our friend Joseph L. Flatley. So, alternative stuff a brewing here on a Thursday night. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com.
Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're tuned into The Ocelli Effect.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. But of course, you'd be some other time, some other place, and no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome. As I speak, though, it is Thursday, and it is the second hour, 9 p.m., just after it anyway, in what we used to call America, in the eastern segment of it. What FEMA region is it? I forget. Anyway, it doesn't matter because I've got guests in other places who might also be in the same time zone as me, but are definitely not in the same region. And who do I have with me in this hour? J.G. Michael and Joseph L. Flatley. And it's really great that I can get both of them together because they are the co-hosts of the Failed State Update. And so we're going to get the Failed State Update. But also, J.G. is most famously the host of the Parallax Views podcast. And man, I'm always amazed, always impressed by the guests, the interviews, the stuff he gets over there. And I'll give you links to all this stuff in the show notes, I promise you. But I have no idea where this conversation's going to go because, yeah, I don't work with a script ever. So anyway, first off, JG, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Pretty good. Working pretty hard lately because trying to keep up with the news cycle and get as many takes as I can on various topics. I know a lot of people are focused on Ukraine right now, but there's so many issues happening.
Well, there's tons of things going on. You need to back off your mic just a little bit, by the way. You're over-modulating it so much.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, it was a little easier because you were just sort of like, you know, like that, distorting for a second there. But anyway, no, I know, and you cover a ton of stuff. You've had some interesting guests over there. I guess we'll start with Parallax Views because that's a little more diversified, and that's kind of weird to say, because Failed State Update is definitely a diverse thing in and of itself. But let's talk about a couple of the guests that you've published interviews with lately, because really cool stuff happening over there. So, bring everybody up to date in case they don't know already.
So, recently I've had a ton of guests on. I had Professor George Demakopoulos on, who is a professor of Orthodox Christianity, theologian, and he actually runs, I think it's the Orthodox Studies Center, but he joined me to talk about how there's possibly going to be a schism in the Orthodox Church, because you have this thing called the Ruski Mir teaching, or the Russian world teaching, that is promoted by the Russian Orthodox Church through the Patriarch of Moscow, Patriarch Kirill. And, you know, a lot of the Orthodox Church doesn't like this teaching and actually says it's heresy.
This teaching basically
is what's used to promote the invasion of Ukraine and justify it.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to ask you about that due to the fact that I had just been watching and reading about, but I was watching a documentary and it caused me to have to do some reading about this exact topic, and I haven't heard this show yet that you did, but I was rather amazed at how there's kind of a parallel between sort of like the Trumpian embrace that the evangelicals partook of, except that, you know, Trump's no longer in office. And it seems like they were rolling it together almost the same way, where it's like, you know, this is the chosen person by God to restore the greatness of the country. I'm being very generic about this, but this is literally what you were discussing, right?
Yeah, and it's been going on for quite some time in Eastern Europe, actually. Mm-hmm. Not just with the Orthodox Church, but believe it or not, there's a whole sort of conspiracy culture in Eastern Europe that is convinced that LGBTQIA or LGBT activism is part of a conspiracy by NATO. There's even a one of these Serbian new extreme films called I won't say the actual title, but Who the F is Milos Brankovic?
Oh.
It was a pretty well-made movie in Serbia, but it's all based on this conspiracy theory that, the gays are being pushed on our traditional culture by NATO. And a lot of this stuff comes from Eastern European sort of traditionalist right-wing Orthodox church types, and it's spread throughout Eastern Europe in a lot of ways. And like I said, it's causing a schism of sorts in the church. It could be a major schism in the Orthodox Church.
Well, see, in America, right, you know, just again to refer to the parallel, in America there is a school of thought that says effectively that these people have been manipulated in order to attempt to destroy the American culture in the same way. It seems actually to be a repeated sort of trope in attempts to, justify the attacks on people that belong under that rainbow flag and have one way or another. The reason why they wanted women's rights is to destroy American culture. The reason why they wanted, again, I'm looking at it through the American lens, but this is a common thing when you examine some of the populist movements one way or another in a lot of places, especially when they attach religiosity to it. How dare you destroy the white Christian nation? How dare you destroy the proper Muslim nation? How dare you? And they always see it as the attack individuals that would rather see the failure of the culture and the country simultaneously.
It's sad to me because I'll be honest, when I look at like evangelical Christianity in America, someone who's a fallen Catholic but still has a little bit of that old Catholicism in me, I've never been very fond of evangelicalism in the U.S., Protestant evangelicalism. I won't get into that, but it's sad to see that happening to the Orthodox Church. And I really there are these religious types that, and I've talked about this with Demakopoulos, this professor, theologian of Orthodox studies. To me, I think if you're a Christian, you should be aware of the temporal world, right? Which is the world of politics, the world of the temporal, rather than the world of the eternal, or the world of faith, right? The world of God.
Right.
And I think when you start, following someone like Alexander Dugin, who is someone that, Alexander Dugin started out as a guy supporting national Bolshevism, and then he got into chaos magic, and now he's a big fan of Orthodox Christianity, or so he says. And I'm like, why would you trust a guy that is into, like, occultism? It seems like this type of phenomena to me, it actually cheapens religion and gets people to turn more towards the secular world. I would think if you're religious, you would actually sort of want to stay away from the seductions of the secular world, but I guess they can't escape it either.
Well, you know what the problem is that for some people, it's a matter of true and devout faith, regardless of how situational that may be, and only in a certain time period that they might be so ensconced in said faith. And for others, it is merely a weapon and a psychological tool for warfare. I can't say that either point is not valid. Or either
well, use. I've said to evangelicals before that believe in QAnon type stuff, they believe that they're fighting Satan, they're going to stop Satan, and I'm like, well, I mean, you've kind of already lost, in my view. I mean, if you're the only thing that can stop Satan and not your faith in God, not that I'm a theological person, but I don't know, there's just something very odd about, what I would say is like Christian far-right politics. I don't see why they're so involved in it. I think it's sad too, because social justice teachings actually have a lot of religious origins, right? I mean, we had the Catholic Workers Movement, and I mean, now all these people, hate anything related to like help the poor, help the needy, that kind of thing.
Well, with the exception of certain orders, again, Catholicism is just as splintered as anything else.
That's true.
Because I personally known people that were anti-nuclear activists. That believed in rights and absolutely at all times maintaining their own poverty and doing good works. This is their mission in life. And they were very good, respectable individuals to me. And they would be seen more as liberal than attaching themselves to any of the right-wing sort of stuff at all. And then I've seen some very right-wing Catholics in my time. And quite frankly, I believe both of them. Both types myself when I encounter them. Let's put on pause the Parallax View stuff because I know we'll get back to it and get to Joseph L. Flatley for a minute. First off, man, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. Can you hear me? Are my levels all right?
Yes, you're okay. You're not overmodulating, sir. You're doing just fine. So,
Lenny, I feel like you walked into the conversation and we're thinking, why are they talking about all this religious stuff? What did I want?
No, man. Well, no, I mean the progressive, the Catholic workers. That's my background, so I feel right at home in this discussion. Actually, no,
fair enough. But you would say there is definitely more than one type of devout Catholic, right?
Oh, there's as many types of Catholics as there are Catholics.
Yeah, there you go. Well,
there's what's his name? Bill Donahue is real right wing, right?
Yeah,
Catholic Defense League or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you're talking about the talk show from the
80s. No, not Phil Donahue.
No.
He was against the Iraq War.
He's talking about the minister named Donahue. Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, wasn't he from Jersey?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, the Catholic Church is an institution, and institutions are made by people, and most people, have some questionable views, or everybody has a questionable view here or there. But I think, there's kind of an important point. It's, the conservative Catholic movement in America is really in ascendance in a way that I don't think you could say, at least since, Father Conklin or, the World War II. I don't think they've been nearly as prominent since then.
Right.
And it has to do with this kind of mind meld with evangelicalism, and it has to do with this kind of like weird current of conservative Catholicism, which were kind of like the original Trumpers, the original QAnon. I mean, believe some really weird stuff. I mean, my dad's going to kill me for saying this because he's her biggest fan, but like watch Mother Angelica on, basic cable if you ever want to like kind of get insight into that weird mindset.
No,
well,
for
also
sure.
a lot of the original paleocons that are in some ways predecessors to the alt-right, like Pat Buchanan, they were also, Buchanan was Catholic.
Uh-huh.
See, and again, you know, I see it through the familial lens because, you know, both sides of my family that came from other countries as immigrant Catholics were completely different than, you know, what their children would become. Mm-hmm. And there was a very conservative view from especially Sicilians and Irish people that came here that carried their Catholicism with them. By just the next generation over, boom, my parents' generations, my father absolutely rejected the church entirely, you know, just through his life experiences and wound up, even though the Methodist church is also under the Catholic banner, and if you don't believe me, just open up one of the Methodist hymns and you'll see they answer to Mother Church too, but they're clearly not the most staunch Catholics. He turned to that because he did not believe in a great many of the things that were most conservative, I guess, in the Catholic faith. You know, and that kind of happened not just through my own personal family lens, but it seemed very common among the grandchildren of those immigrants that there is a marked difference. I mean, you know, my grandfather would have definitely been, you know, a devout church guy who gave his money no matter what he had and all that to the church, and felt as though that was his duty to do so, and it was, there was no question of it, right? You know, and today his grandson is a multi-faith minister who also has a Master of Wicca certificate on his wall. So, you know, I'm just saying, it's a different era, folks, definitely, and these things evolve. So, meanwhile, though, a failed state update is certainly not all devoted to religion. So how about we get a little bit of an update on the failed state update, Mr. Flatley?
Well, thank you. The site's been a little slow. I'm working on a big blockbuster feature that has to do with the Wolverine Watchmen trial, and that's been taking up all my time. So I'm thinking subscribers... Mm-hmm. Well, to the newsletter, we'll probably see it on Monday or Tuesday, and the general public will probably see it Wednesday or Thursday. And in the meantime, JG has been doing phenomenal work on the site, covering the IPT spy scandal. CARE, the Muslim American Civil Rights Group, was spied upon and surveilled upon by this weird conservative right-wing nonprofit group called IPT, and kind of like a privatized COINTELPRO. And JG's done some writing and did a podcast about it.
Well, so JG, this week for the listeners, what is the IPTI? I think that's the correct the letters.
Yeah, the IPT. So IPT is the Investigative Project on Terrorism. It was started by Steve Emerson. Right. And just to give you an idea of who Steve Emerson is, he gets into all of this, I think, in 1995. And then IPT gets founded. And early on, he's one of the big proponents of one of the most ludicrous conspiracy theories. I always mention this one. He is one of the proponents of the third terrorist theory, which was promoted by a journalist by the name of Yana Davis about the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, what is that theory? That's the theory that the Oklahoma City bombing was done by none other than Saddam Hussein and jihadists. I think Al-Qaeda, actually.
So
I'm not sure that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein had that much of a smooth relationship for that to actually work, so I don't even understand that. But he's one of the people that promoted that, along with a number of other rather interesting characters over the year have supported that.
So John Doe number 3 is actually an Arab, is what you're telling me, yeah?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Just checking. okay, sorry.
Do you happen to know, there was a book that came out recently by a former CIA guy, I think it was called Operation Red Dragon, about... the JFK assassination was actually all Khrushchev's fault. Are you familiar with that?
I am aware of not the book. I am aware of the pre-publication version of that book. and you're talking about the thing that Brennan was involved in, right?
Yes. James Woolsey was the author of that book, and Woolsey is another guy who was very high up in the CIA, and I think he was an ambassador too. He also believed in this Oklahoma City bombing conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
So it's real popular with elements of the right, but that's beside the point.
And the idea with
of the kind of craziness that comes out of IPT.
Yeah, just bullet points on the JFK theory they have is that Oswald was truly a Russian agent, and he assassinated Kennedy on behalf of the, you know, the Communist Party. Basically it.
Another important thing to bring up or illuminating thing is...
Are you sure it's important?
In the run-up to 9/11, you know, FBI was doing such a great job keeping track of Al-Qaeda, the Clinton administration actually used IPT to provide them with information about Al-Qaeda because they couldn't even trust the FBI to get it right.
Yeah, of course.
So they have friends in high places, you know, depending on the administration, and but they're totally unaccountable because they're private, a nonprofit.
They're unaccountable, and they believe in, you know, I mean, they believe, you know, there's Arabs under my bed. The Arabs are coming. The Arabs are coming.
Those guys,
you know, that's why I brought up the Oklahoma City bombing thing, because they seem to blame everything on Arabs. There's sort of a milieu that has done this over the years.
Kind of ties to the Orthodox. It kind of ties to the church thing too, because the whole, you know, clash of civilizations, they're coming to bring us Sharia law and all this kind of thing. It all kind of gets into that.
Oh yeah, they're the people that helped start that.
Yes.
You know? I think they helped mainstream it in a lot of ways.
They have, and it's pretty frightening. But your investigative piece focuses on them going after CARE. Right?
Yes, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which I think elements of the anti-CARE sort of milieu, probably connected to IPT, have, you know, a lot of these types call CARE the Muslim Mafia, and they claim that it's a terrorist organization and all these kinds of things. And I mean, I think CARE has had like one incident where it was found out that someone involved had like ties to shady elements in the Middle East, and they promptly, you know, fixed that problem. But you know, they can never do enough to exonerate themselves. And IPT decided to go after them through a character by the name of Roman Iqbal, who was the leader of the Ohio chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations.
There's a handle for you, by the way, Roman Iqbal. Go ahead. Sorry, I just wanted to stop and pause on that for a second, because if my name was Roman Iqbal, I might have to start out every single day by slapping myself. Go ahead. Please continue, Jay.
So, for listeners, if you look up the story on Field State Update, which is private sector snoops caught spying on Muslim activists in the United States, Roman Iqbal has these correspondences in email with Steve Emerson, and Emerson is telling his employees at IPT, be ready. Roman's going to have an avalanche of recordings that he's going to share with us. So literally, Roman Iqbal appeared to have been snooping and recording conversations between people at CARE and tracking CARE's internal workings, especially when they would talk to politicians and people in Congress, and just feeding this all back to IPT. Then it came out that Roman Iqbal was doing this, was acting as a mole for IPT within the Council on American Islamic Relations. And that came about because there was a whistleblower at IPT who remains anonymous, but he provided emails to CARE. And CARE didn't know what to make of this at first, right? This could all be nonsense. Mm-hmm. Then they learned more and more, and everything started checking out. And it's interesting because that IPT whistleblower said, you know, I thought that what I was doing was to protect us from, you know, terror threats. But then I found out, you know, this was really about shutting down Muslim American voices and pro-Palestinian activists and things of that nature, basically shutting down people with a different view who weren't even terrorists. So this whistleblower leaks these emails to IPT, and the emails get really interesting at a certain point because you have certain emails coming from two officials with names connected to the Israeli PMO, the Prime Minister's office under Netanyahu. One of them is an email from a man by the name of Ido I believe Ido Mizrahi. Hopefully I'm not mispronouncing that. But in that specific email, Ido asks, and this is an email associated with the Israeli PMO, the Prime Minister's office, and he signs off as Director of Intelligence or something on along those lines. So this man was presenting as an intelligence agent for the Israelis under Netanyahu. And he actually says in an email, do you have any information that could tie the student group Students for Justice in Palestine to Hamas? Israel was literally asking for IPT's help in essentially snooping on a student activist group. Now, I'm not sure they would find anything to connect Hamas and Students for Justice in Palestine, but to me that was really shocking. And in addition to this piece I wrote, I interviewed Edward Ahmed Mitchell, who is the Deputy Director of CARE, a former journalist and an attorney, about this. And we were both, you know, talking about, you know, the targeting of a student group. I mean, this is what – this is the type of stuff that J. Edgar Hoover would be like, yeah, I'm down for that, you know? I mean, I guess COINTELPRO has gone nonprofit now, right?
Well, look, if it works, you know, if it works in the public sector, why not perfect it in the private sector? I mean, so wow. And this is all up at Failed State Update, or is this
This is all up at Failed State Update, and the emails I'm referencing you can see on Failed State Update. And that email, like I said, the one that gave me chills was what seems to be an Israeli official from Netanyahu's government basically saying, can you, you know, snoop on a student activist group? It just, I mean, I don't know. For some reason, that gives me chills, you know.
See, it doesn't chill me at all because I totally expect people connected to the Israel's government to spy on American assets of any kind at all times, because they're generally one of the most aggressive foreign nations to do so here on the government, and why not the people as well? Plus, you know, we've heard about the telecommunications stuff and all these other things, and then you wind up finding out that they're tied to Israeli intelligence, on and on and on. So I don't know. I'm not as shocked.
I'm not saying I find it surprising, though, Chuck. Okay. I'm saying I find it chilling. Like, that's very bothersome to me to see student activists, especially because I've known student activists from my time in college. Just to see them targeted to me is such a, you know, it's very sad.
No, fair enough. Interesting thing. I want to post something to Joe here real fast, because in the chat room, a funny a proposition is made about Q, since Q was mentioned here in the discussion briefly. You know, and I find this interesting intellectual judo that goes on, where now there are people trying to say that, you know, oh, maybe it was actually created by leftists in order so that they had a way of, you know, tarnishing people. And
there's a theory that it was Michael Avenatti the whole time.
Michael Avenatti.
I'm not even joking. There's people that believe that.
Avenatti, like, for real.
Yeah, Stormy Daniels' lawyer.
Okay, nice. I'm sorry. It's almost like the people that try to bring L. Ron Hubbard into the JFK assassination. It's like, I can't.
That's a new one to me.
Oh, no, they have. The Golden Dawn, all that stuff. You know, it's like it all ties together, and perhaps it was Scientologists that wanted him killed. Anyway, yeah, that's there somewhere. Probably a little more likely than the Oswald is a Russian agent thing. But anyway, just saying. You know,
and then the Rosicrucians got RFK, so.
Well, of course they did. You know that. I mean, all right. Anyway, you know, competing Catholic factions, that's all that was. It was a little, you know, in-house squabble. whatever. I'm being facetious. If anybody takes this seriously, I don't know.
Don't cite that in your research, people.
Please do not. Anyways, but you know, Joe, again, this is some fascinating stuff JG is going through. I know you also had some pieces, again, following up on some other religious cults and stuff like that. Since we're seemingly in that area, that pocket of strange beliefs, I know you had some stuff like that recently too. I don't remember if we covered it last time, because quite frankly, you put out a lot of stuff through Failed State Update that is really entertaining to read because you don't leave it dry, and I appreciate that when you do your writing.
Well, thanks.
Because it's always like I get an attitude off of Flatley's writing when he does stuff, yeah. And I love the attitude because it's completely unique. Again, you know, I mean, JG is unique as well. That's why I think they're a perfect couple, so to speak, here. Not trying to say you guys need to get married or anything. I'm saying that, you know, I mean, if you did, fine, you know, but anyway, the thing is, I don't
like where this is going, Chuck.
Yeah, and I know you don't, neither do I. But the thing is, it's my head. You know, I love the combination of the two of you, though, because it's two very unique voices that are now combined with this effort, and it's like I couldn't have. If you would have asked me who you need to pick over there, I wouldn't have picked JG. But once you did, it was like, oh, that's just perfect, because you got two entirely unique writers, people with thought processes that are differing from one another, and you guys work, you collaborate together just oh so well, and it's a unique, you know, bunch of unique stuff that you're not going to get elsewhere. Through failed state updates. So, but I know you've
Hey, can I butt in here for a second real quick?
But why not, JG? Sure.
I just saw your chat room. Apparently someone's mad at me because they're saying I should be chilled by citizens snitching on their neighbors for holding barbecues in their backyards. I just want to say I am not for snitching on your neighbors for doing barbecues in their backyards. You know, I may not think COVID is the scamdemic, but you know, I'm also not like, let's throw everyone who doesn't get vaccinated in jail.
Well,
the comment kind of pissed me off, to be honest. Sorry.
All right, no problem. But I firmly stand behind the idea that, you know, snitches are not a good thing.
I agree.
So, you know,
I think we can all agree that snitches get stitches.
Oh, yeah. At the very least. Anyways, so where was I? I forgot now. Oh, that's right. I was asking you about some of the other stuff that you covered recently, a couple of different cults. I mean, one of them we're well familiar with because you did a whole podcast series and a book, which, by the way, you can get a hold of Joe's book over there, too. And I definitely encourage you to check out that book, which is what again there, Joe, published by Farrell House?
New Age Grifter, the true story of Gabriel of Urantia and his cosmic family, about a UFO cult that's hiding in the desert waiting for the end of the world, and they might not be entirely wrong this time.
But, well, see, here we go.
they've been waiting since 89, and you know, it seems like maybe their wish is going to come true.
Yeah, I you know, I don't know what kind of gratification somebody will get the time that they guess it right. You know, not just him, but I mean, there's been plenty of doomsday cultist type people who have felt as though, you know, the world should have ended on XYZ date, et cetera, and we know about them. But it's always fascinating to me to think, well, one of these days, somebody's going to be very right, and it's going to run right up to it, and I wonder how long they'll have to say, I told you so, before things come to fruition.
Well, you know, they're going to be rescued by a spaceship, so they'll have plenty of time to lord it over us. Well, maybe not us, because we'll all be dead. But,
well, see, that's the other thing, is even if they get to survive and escape, I mean, you know, who do they got to tell except each other?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
It's a real...
It's way too airtight. You know, it's like, you'll be sorry when the world ends. I'll be sorry anyway if the world ends. I mean, it doesn't matter what you said or what I did beforehand. If that's coming, it's coming.
Yeah, I'll have a bigger... problems in what Gabriel Villarancha thinks if the world ends, you know.
Really, you know, but of course, why are you bringing that up? Well, a lot of people are talking again about some things that, well, quite frankly, I remember from my childhood. I mean, you guys are a little younger, but, you know, it was a fairly intense time in the early 80s when you know, certain things culturally and just politically seemed to indicate that we were at a very dangerous precipice. When it came to nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapons have now come up in a lot of discussions due to the situation in Europe, let's call it, and the fact that there is a nuclear-powered nation making aggressive moves and stating that, you know, if we see an existential threat to us, we may indeed utilize these things. In the past 24 hours, I think we had another missile test from Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, North Korea. Oh.
You know, I mean, I know that's...
Could I comment on that real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was looking for.
So I was going to say, I just did a episode of Parallax Views on that, and I'm not... This is not a defense of Kim Jong-un. That's probably not a good way to start this, but it's interesting. That missile test actually coincides with the election of a new president-elect to South Korea. And I think people should pay attention to that, because the new president-elect, whose name I don't want to even say because I'm probably going to butcher it, he's part of the People's Power Party in South Korea. He's extremely hawkish on North Korea.
Right.
So I think what we're seeing with that is North Korea reacting to that hawkishness, and things could really heat up. What we're probably going to see is a continued buildup of arms in the Asia Pacific, because this new South Korean president being so hawkish, and you know, North Korea having all its own issues. Yeah, we're going to see a lot of heat in that area of the world.
Yeah, well, we're going to see some interesting things, and at all times, I think it is a fairly wise decision to keep track of a nation state that is indeed nuclear powered and has a dead man at the head of its government, because that is North Korea. You know, Kim Jong-un's grandfather is still technically the head of state there, even though he's dead. Just saying. As far as I understand, perhaps I misunderstand, but that's what I understand about their governmental structure. And it does seem like they are the convenient puppet out there that appears and makes some sort of threat, existential or otherwise, by making a display of their weaponry. And they do that, it seems to me, like, hey, don't forget about me, guys, no matter what's going on in the world. And, well, you know, here we go again, so to speak. Yeah, no, and I think you're right, though, keep track of that, because if South Korea decides to get belligerent or even mildly belligerent, we could have a whole other situation occurring in a completely separate region of the world outside of the one we're looking at now.
Yeah, and the only reason I mention that is, you know, it's not about defending North Korea, but South Korea also has its own history that a lot of people don't get into in the West. So right. Specifically the Gwangju Massacre. That happened, I believe, in the 1970s. You know, there hasn't all the track record for human rights hasn't always been great in South Korea either.
Right.
And there's a lot of bad blood between both countries that Americans simply, I think, don't have a firm grasp on.
Right. No, very true. But then again, you know, what do Americans have a firm grasp on when it comes to the history of anything? you know, I mean, seriously, the whole Ukrainian thing, which is dominating the discussions everywhere, they got no clue about the history there, except that, well, that used to be part of the Soviet Union. If they even say Soviet Union, they might just say that used to be part of Russia. And, well, okay. You know, it's very, very weird to watch people, like, just be historically ignorant to what it is they're looking at and make a very, very wide-sweeping declarative statements about what should be, what was, and what will be in places that they have no understanding of. A good example of that is India and what it is they decide to do, because there's been some interesting discussions lately about how much Russian oil they're going to continue to use at this time and stuff like this, not recognizing the dependent relationship they have on pretty much a whole bunch of nation states that are not super popular with the West. Okay, so, you know, and why? Well, maybe if they had been handled differently at a different point in time, and maybe if Pakistan wasn't given the blessing during the war on terror, this might not be the circumstance today. You know, people are very short-sighted about these things. And
I was going to say, I think that's an important point, because I've heard people say, oh, why isn't Venezuela playing ball with us now? Or, you know, why is Cuba responding this way to the Ukraine situation? And I'm thinking to myself, well, you guys should know the history of U.S.-Cuba relations.
Yeah.
Comment on that.
Well, that's the thing, is that if you understand that a little bit, you might be not even remotely perplexed about their reactions. Very much like you were talking about with South Korea, where people don't understand that difference. It's like, well, it's just a dividing line. But no, these are two now distinctly different cultures, post-Korean conflict. And there is good reason for suspicion and worry on actually both sides. And again, I'm not somebody who's defending Kim Jong-un, but I'm just saying there's good reason for that tension. And without intervention and assistance, I mean, things could easily go sideways there. I mean, just the fact that he fires missiles in the direction of Japan should tell you something. You know, just, hey, by the way, I can reach you real easy. There is a message in all these movements, and if you don't know the context, it's sometimes impossible to decipher. But
yeah, I think that's really important, by the way, too. I just I'm working on editing an interview I did with someone who was very involved with Colonel Gaddafi in Libya.
Mm-hmm.
I won't give away too much more than that, but their opinions on NATO were very negative, and I think they had a different take on the Ukraine situation as a result. And it was very interesting to me because, you know, I sort of understood where they were coming from in a way, because they were hit by NATO bombs. They were hit by shrapnel and injured by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, although I don't agree with their views necessarily, I can understand why, you know, there are people in Libya looking at all of this and saying, you know, screw off NATO, right? I think people should try to understand context a lot more when it comes to other cultures.
Yeah, no,
and
definitely.
How they respond to global events.
Well, definitely. And again, you got to take a look at the generational position of who's in power, too. You know, at this time, in a place like Iraq, what is the memory of the individuals who are starting to run that country, right? What is their memory of, say, the West and their attitude toward us? If it is particularly negative, I cannot blame them.
You know, another good example of that, right, is, you know, we're doing the new Iran deal talks, right? I mean, mm-hmm. which Mike Pence has already gone to Israeli leadership and said, hey, don't worry, if we get a new Iran deal, when we get back into power, the Republicans will just rip it up. Which, you know, I think if Iran sees that, they're going to be like, well, why are we doing this?
Right.
But it's interesting because people don't realize, you know, the Iranian leadership that's in power remembers when Iraq invaded Iran and used chemical weapons against Iranians, and who supported Saddam during that. It was the U.S.
Right.
People have to understand this context. Otherwise, they don't understand why there's all these hard feelings between, you know, the U.S. and Iran and, you know, a bunch of other countries, too.
Well, and also, you know, why it is that we're not necessarily trusted in negotiations sometimes. Well, it might be because, you know, every 4 years you got to roll the dice as to who's actually going to have control of the levers of power. And it's not even necessarily just about the presidency. You know, you get different let's call them urinating contests there in Congress, and you never know where funding might go, depending on changes in regime that are constantly in flux here. So, you know, I get it when some people are skeptical about the deals offered and things, too. You know, and that's not even necessarily about full-on conflict or organized violence in one way or another. Sometimes it's about, you know, the treatment of certain nations under different individuals being in positions of power in this country. It can shift a little more wildly than people think. So, you know, there's a lot to consider there. Meanwhile, like I said, Joe, I know somehow it seems like me and JG have been talking back and forth a lot, and we did talk about some of the stuff there, and we did promo your book, but a couple other things. I want to get into what's coming up on the Failed State Update, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure. I mean, right now I'm focused pretty exclusively on this feature on the Wolverine Watchmen case. I've just been kind of fascinated by the arguments, you know, for or against whether or not this was FBI entrapment. I mean, I think that it's hard to prove entrapment when you're running around in the woods, you know, reconning the person's house that you plan on kidnapping. But, you know, between the two poles of entrapment, not entrapment, there's a lot of room. And, you know, I've just been really, I've kind of cottoned on to this whole idea that, you know, what motivates militia people, like the far right crazy militia people, I'm not saying that they all are, I'm saying a certain subset. And what motivates, you know, and how does the FBI use that motivation? You mm-hmm. know, it's kind of like we're talking about some super angry people, militia people in Michigan who planned to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And it was like, to what extent was that because the world sucks? What extent is that because the FBI manipulated them? It's a fascinating question. So that's kind of like what I've been looking into these last few weeks.
And see, it is a fascinating question because there is the question of what is actually organic among these groups, which, by the way, they can get to some pretty wild ideas all by themselves. And I've had plenty of interactions with some of these guys, and some of them I respect and think are just very decent people who have a skewed view of the world, and that's okay. Others I think are actually dangerous. And here's the thing: when government agencies enact operations that, in my estimation, gaslight some of these people, you know, then you have to start to question who is actually responsible for provoking a lot of different actions that you see. And in some cases, I would say, you know, again, it's like going back to the whole Randy Weaver thing. You know, not a fan of his, but I don't believe that the right thing was done there in governmental response. Okay, and Branch Davidians disagree with them or whatever. Again, another point of what in the hell went on there. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that truth is going to ever be fully known, actually. And, you know, and here we go. There are some people that have claimed to me directly about this Wolverine Watchmen situation that that this is completely fabricated, that there is absolutely nothing to it. You know, these guys are all innocent. It's the very same people that would say, you know, nobody actually died on January 6th in the Capitol. It's the same kind of people who would, you know, the what is it? Go Kyle, go or whatever, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but this ties into what we were talking about earlier, right?
It does.
With Muslim Americans, because throughout the War on Terror years with Bush and even Obama, you know, the FBI was doing stings and entrapment operations against Muslim Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, I'm talking to one of the lawyers in the Wolverine Watchmen case, but I don't have like a real in-depth inside knowledge of that case.
Right,
because it's still under trial. But there is a story on Failed State Update, an interview with a guy, somewhat similar circumstances. His name's Bradford Metcalf. He was a militia man in Michigan 30 years ago.
Right.
And he was set up. He took the fall. At, you know, there's an ATF sting. He took the fall, went to jail for 40 years. He's been in jail for 20 prison. He's been in prison for 20 years, 25 years now. And I have my living room's a mess. I got boxes of documents everywhere, including the ATF undercover files that the undercover agent had to file about the case. And it's super clear that this guy did not do anything except associate with the wrong people.
Right.
And it's really fascinating to be able to have an inside look at how one of these cases is constructed. This guy in Metcalf, I'm in touch with him. He's in prison. We talk through the prison email system. He made the mistake of not playing the game when the prosecutors came to him and wanted him to take a plea deal. He stood up for himself, and you know, he represented himself, which is never a good idea, especially when your knowledge of the law comes from like Sport or Soldier Fortune magazine or something. Mm-hmm. But the guy was boned is the whole point.
Right.
And that just happens so often. The Wolverine Watchmen case, it's not that cut and dry. One of the biggest reasons it's not that cut and dry is because they're not like going after them for like some fuzzy statute, like seditious conspiracy. They are going after them for kidnapping. Everybody knows what kidnapping is.
Right.
There's proven case law of kidnapping. It's illegal. Attempted kidnapping is illegal. And these guys were definitely ready to do it. I'm more interested in parsing the motivations and, you know, the events around, the bigger picture events, because the entrapment thing is going to be really tough. It's going to be really tough to prove, but I think there must be some truth to it. I just don't know, you know.
Well,
When the scales of justice are displayed, I don't know which way they're going to lean precisely, you know.
Well, see, that's the thing, is I don't trust any of the people in the situation to, you know, to be coming forth, you know, with full disclosure on this. And
right.
Indeed, you know, I'm not even saying that, you know, every single one of these things. And look, you can be involved in a conspiracy and plan a crime and never execute it and be prosecuted. I mean, these are things that do occur. That there's legal precedent for that. And yeah, again, I think the motivations are interesting, because my biggest question about something like this is always as follows. Let's just say you succeed. What is the immediate outcome that you expect here that's going to give you the positive result, right?
The boogaloo.
Yeah, okay.
It's this now, magical thing. It goes, you know, even, you know, Charles Manson, you know, James Mason.
We haven't seen Boogaloo Boys lately, though.
That if one inciting event happens, then all of a sudden the world's going to explode and they're going to have a civil war and white people are going to win. It's the most ridiculous magical thinking.
It's the strangest thing, too, because, you know, I had a discussion recently with journalist Ivor Davis, who it was an off-air discussion because he was being interviewed by somebody else that was doing a show on my network. And thing is, you know, he pretty much claims that Bugliosi got that theory off of him. And he was one of the first journalists down to, like, interview some of the Manson family people right after. And I find the whole thing really, really sketchy. About,
you know what's crazy, though? Time and time and again in history, people do have this, do have that theory. So it's like you would think, there's no way Manson and his followers, even as crazy as they are, would believe something this crazy. But it's kind of common, I'm finding, with different, like, weird cult groups and stuff. And I don't call them cults because I don't agree with what they believe in. I'm talking about this weird dynamic where there's a leader and followers and they all kind of go crazy together.
Yeah, but that's the thing. There's a high control group that is, and I like that phrase, a high control group that is in play and usually has some faith-based ethos that is attached to it that is quite outside of the mainstream. And that's the way I see these groups, one way or another. Although, one quick question before we run out of time. I haven't seen...
I got to add something in real quick.
Well, just let me ask this question, and then I'll let you guys go ahead and wrap up the whole thing, both of you. And this is for Joe mainly, but you can answer too, JG. I haven't seen any Boogaloo Boys lately, actually, anywhere.
That's exactly what I wanted to address, because I saw someone in the chat... mentioned it, but go on, Lenny. You go first.
Yeah, please.
You know, they were so motivated, so energized by the George Floyd protests, and those kind of petered out.
They seemed to go away with that, didn't they?
What's that?
Those guys seemed to disappear when that did.
Yes.
Okay.
It's very odd. I just feel like there's a boom and bust cycle to everything, including extremism.
Fair enough. JG chomping at the bit. Go ahead.
I do not think the far right or the alt right has disappeared. People want to say that. I think the reason you're not seeing them is because they're being kicked off platforms like Facebook and Twitter. But that doesn't mean they've gone away. And I have reasons for thinking that. We'll get into it another time. But when I was in D.C., I actually came across some people that were very much on the fringes of the right and, you know, kind of spooky people. This is outside of the conference I went to. I had nothing to do with that. But
JG, I don't mean to suggest at all that the far right wing or any of the right wing fringes have really disappeared. I'm just saying specifically I don't see the Boogaloo Boys everywhere like I did for a little bit. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, that's fair. I think a lot of them are on Telegram now, though. A lot of them are on Discord servers, sort of working under the cloak.
I mean, where we would see them is at, like, a open carry rally at the courthouse or something. And it's like, that stuff seems to have died down. And I think kind of JG brings up an interesting point. You know, they're obviously able to recruit and talk amongst themselves on Telegram and MeWe and these, like, alternative platforms. Mm-hmm. But can they get the numbers if they're on these, like, ridiculous third-tier platforms? I mean, like, you go to an open carry rally, and it's really, like, four militia guys, three boogaloos, and then, like, hundreds of just, like, pissed-off Trump fans.
Yeah.
Pardon my French.
No,
you know, it's
enough.
Like, you know, if those rallies aren't happening, if the normies, you know, the conservative right-wing, you know, normies aren't there to, like, pad the numbers, do they...
if a protest happens in the woods and nobody's around to hear it, does it make a sound? You know,
I totally.
That's
understand
when things
that,
get yeah. really scary, right? Because I don't know. I think these people that are, you know, being banished to the realm of Telegram, I think they're still networking, and I think they're becoming more radical because they're becoming more and more isolated.
Yeah, there's something to that, but at the same time, if you look at, and I just did a deep dive 3 hours ago into like all the Boogaloo violence and all the Boogaloo arrests over the last 3 years, because they've only really been around since 2019 or 2020. They were always glomming on, almost invariably glomming on to social justice protests, usually George Floyd protests. Right. So it's like, you know, there's something odd about that particular subculture, but you're absolutely right. You know, people might put away the Hawaiian shirts, the Jimmy Buffett Aloha shirts, but, you know, they're going to find something to do that's even worse. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm bracing myself
for. Well, you see, that's the other weird thing to consider is that in smaller groups, it actually creates a greater possibility for action, because in a smaller group, it is easier to marshal motivated individuals who are very intensely active in a small echo chamber. And I think that, quite frankly, it does make them effectively smaller groups that are more dangerous, directly speaking. But then again, that's just my opinion. So what should we tell people to go look for? You know, like, as always, go to Failed State Update. LennyFlatley.net is a place to go. I know that I'll give the you know, different links in the show notes here for both JG and Joseph L. Flatley's work, including his great book, which I have on the shelf here. And I know we did one show on it at some point, but I and we did many shows on the so-called Prophet from Pittsburgh podcast, which I enjoyed immensely. And that is a fascinating story just all by itself. If this was the only thing you were talking about lately, it would be one thing. And I didn't even get to ask you guys about what you thought about the Hunter Biden laptop stuff lately. So maybe that for another day, maybe in 2 weeks, who knows. But by then,
we didn't even get to talk about the new FBI documents about Saudi Arabia, 9/11.
See, yeah. A whole bunch of stuff we missed. We got to make an agenda next time, guys. But go ahead, JG, and give people your parting thoughts, and then we'll go to Joe, and then we'll just play the music and be done.
Okay, so parallaxviews.podbean.com. You can also go to my Patreon page, patreon.com/parallaxviews. I'm going to be updating that in the next few days. I have an episode coming out that's the last in a series I've done on the covert history of George H.W. Bush. Also, I want to plug an episode I did with global economics correspondent for the New York Times, Peter Goodman, who, you know, I know some of you heard New York Times and are like, oh no, but he wrote a really good book recently called Davos Man: How the Billionaires Devoured the World, and it gets into the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab and all these other characters, but not in the way you might think. I know a lot of right-wingers like to talk about Davos Man, but what they don't like to talk about is how Klaus Schwab defended Trump in 2018. He invited Trump to the Davos Forum, where all the elites gather, and said, oh, he's been misunderstood and he's so inclusive. And there's a lot of evidence to show that Trump sold his own constituents down the river for the ultra wealthy worldwide. And me and Peter Goodman got into that on the Monday edition of Parallax Views. Nice. And I also really quickly just want to plug, I have an interview coming up with Haweda Araf, who is the founder of the International Solidarity Movement. She's running for Congress in Michigan, and she is a bad mamma jamma. So I hope everyone will listen to that interview when it's out in the next week or so. Haweda Araf, and you can look her up, just Google her. She is a bad mamma jamma running for Congress, and just a mom, an activist, a human rights attorney. And that is going to be a whirlwind of an episode.
Nice. Joseph L. Flatley.
Yeah, support independent journalism and support a indigent journalist. Go to LennyFlatley.net. If you click on newsletter, you can subscribe to the newsletter. $7 a month would be a great help, and you'll get exclusive content sent to your email address. Click on the Failed State Update link. Go to the news site, read all the articles, listen to the podcasts, check out the Failed State Jukebox. Yeah, LennyFlatley.net.
There you go. And by the way, I do have an unedited version of that Failed State Update Jukebox episode that we did in the Ocelli member section. So,
nice.
Just telling you guys,
exclusive
it's a little
content.
It's a little different than the one that you released there, Joe. He had to do a lot of editing on that, I just want to say. So if you want to hear the unedited, really absolutely awesome sounds of disgust from me and JG especially, I would suggest you check out my members section as well. But at all times, support independent journalists, people that are supporting your ability to get at real information. Those are the people you should support. Thanks to Mike Swanson for being with me in the first hour. Thanks to J.G. Michael and Joseph L. Flatley for being with me in the second. Remember this, guys. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.
Thanks, Chuck.